description of God, or this title for God, or however you want to phrase it, God is the God of lost causes, which I think is an appropriate way to think about God, among other things. So one could, based on these gospel readings, and in fact this entire section in Mark, last week we heard about the disciples in the boat, and the storm came up and was swamping the boat, and they were perishing basically. As far as they could tell, the ship was going to go down, or the boat was going to go down, and they wake Jesus up and say, "Don't you care?" We skipped over in the first part of Mark 5, where Jesus heals this man who's possessed by the evil spirits so that he cannot live in society. The spirits give him this awful strength that he can tear apart any bounds, so that you can't even throw him in prison, and he lives in the wild out in among the tombs. And Jesus heals this man. And now in this story today, Jesus comes back across the lake to basically where he'd left, or presumably where he'd left from the day before. And we get this story of these two impossible things, the incurable disease and the dead girl. And so we could say that Jesus is the Jesus of lost causes. That doesn't sound right, but that Jesus specializes in lost causes. And so I think that this is part of what the lectionary wanted us to sort of wrestle with today because of the passage in Lamentations. And so I'd like to just reflect a little bit about this idea of lost causes, or the idea of how disappointment and suffering and pain, the bad things or the hard things in our life, can be the occasion to meet God. Because that's what the lectionary is inviting us into today. It's easy to want to distance ourselves from these things in our life and to, in many ways, ignore them or deny them, if at all possible. For sure, to sort of curtail them. But the Bible wants us to understand that these are a blessing to us. So, for instance, in the gospel, Jairus would never have met Jesus had his daughter not been very sick on the point of death. Jairus is a synagogue leader. He's a respectable part of the leadership that has, there's been a growing tension and distance between Jesus and the Jewish leaders. And so Jairus, at risk of his own reputation and dignity, comes to Jesus driven by this desperation. He's at his wit's end. His daughter is sick. And like any parent, his heart is very broken and goes out to this young girl and wants to do whatever he can to find help for her. And so this is a good thing if we would say, so from the perspective of eternity, right? From the perspective of 20, 30, 40, 60 years of life, it's not a good thing for your child to be sick. But from the perspective of eternity, this becomes an invitation that otherwise we may not have had in our life. And that's true for Jairus, it's true for the woman with the incurable disease. How would she have connected with Jesus? Now, we don't know. Things could have happened other ways. But presumably, she would not have connected with Jesus either. And in fact, she tried hard not to connect with Jesus. And Jesus calls her out, right? Which is an interesting part of how we should manage and respond to our disappointments. Jesus and God did not want to be some sort of magical fix, some sort of supernatural technology that we can enact to get benefit to ourselves, because Jesus is much less interested in healing the woman's body than he is in restoring her dignity and her personhood. So this woman in her day, because of the Jewish regulations, not only was she made a pauper and lived with the inconvenience and discomfort and probably the life-draining effect of the hemorrhaging, but she was also unclean and impure in the Mosaic law, so she would have been restricted from the fellowship and gathering of God's people, from the temple and synagogue, and she would have been an outcast because her uncleanness would contaminate whomever she came into touch or contact with, whomever she touched. And so what Jesus does is, I mean, this is just a bit of psychology. Someone who sneaks in and gets healed and then sneaks away is still a sneaker, right? You got to think Gollum here, Gollum and Sam, Samwise Gamgee. Yeah, she's still a sneaker. And Jesus is like, no, daughter of Abraham, you're not going to sneak in here and sneak back out. You're going to be embraced in love. You're going to be exposed. And she was. Like, on one hand, you could go, that was a very mean thing, a very cruel thing for you to do, Jesus. This woman had her reasons to want to remain incognito. She would have to openly admit that she was violating and flaunting the policies that said, for one thing, don't go around touching other people because you're making them unclean. And admitting, confessing that she'd lived with this in front of, you know, a crowd of strangers, in front of Jesus. But all of these things Jesus says needs to happen so that he might look her in the eye and say, go in peace, flourish, right? Shalom, human flourishing. Be restored to dignity and personhood. I'm reading a lot into this, but this is what occurs in that very brief transaction. Your faith has saved you, has made you well. Go in peace. And Jesus gives her the gift of the full transformation of an encounter with God in the midst of her lost cause. She comes at wit's end. So one thing we can sort of glean from this, or maybe we need to ask ourselves the question, but I think it's still true, that most humans do not come to God, not in a serious way, not in a concerted way, not in a way that says, I surrender all, like we sometimes sing, unless we too are at our wit's end, unless we are at the end of our own resources and abilities. Unless we too are a lost cause or have something in our life that is a lost cause, something for which we've longed and yearned and hoped and striven for, to see resolved, to see healed, to see changed, to see transformed, and it only gets worse, or perhaps it just stays the same, and finally we're ready to give up. And it's almost as if God says, I was just waiting for you to step off the path so that I could have a clear shot at this thing. I needed you to get out of the way so that I could begin to work. And there's countless, countless lives that you could read and find both in the Bible, the two we heard here, and in the century since, where people would say that's exactly what happened. When I was finally ready to give up, that's when God began to work. When I was finally able and willing to let go, that's when God stepped in. So that's one of the benefits of these things, these hard things. The problem is, of course, that things have to get even harder before they begin to be this blessing. I like the way that Jeremiah approaches this in Lamentations. Now, the book of Lamentations is a book of psalms or prayers that Jeremiah writes. Jeremiah, there's a book, one of the prophets, and Jeremiah is writing at the very ends of the Jewish nation before it's hauled off into captivity and at the various stages of the decimating of the Jewish nation. And he takes this very to heart. And so in his prophecy, he's got some of these laments and other, like a lot of pathos. But the Book of Lamentations is just this, it's like a prayer diary. Jeremiah is just like, man, this hurts and it sucks. And so it's a very interesting read that way. But in the middle of this, Jeremiah's got this insight or understanding that he offers us. And it's something like this. We began this passage, verse 19 says, remember my affliction, my wandering, the wormwood and bitterness. Surely my soul remembers and is bowed down within me. This I recall to mind, therefore I have hope. And now some people translate the hope to the forward, because then he goes on to say the steadfast love of the Lord never ceases. Sorry, I'm not given the version we read, but I think it's in the song we sing, the chorus. But I think there's probably a good reason, not that I'm a Hebrew scholar, but I think there's a good reason to read the hope as tying back to the memory of his need and his brokenness. And I think it goes something like this. Whatever else Jeremiah says is going on in my life, I know that God's mercies are faithful and enduring. They're everlasting. I know that God is merciful. So when I find myself in this place of abject need, then I can be hopeful because a God of mercy is going to respond to abject need. Now, this is an insight that's part of the tradition of the last 2,000 years, spiritual writers. Wilfred Stinnison, I came across this in a very direct and concrete manner. He's talking about Thérèse of Lisieux, the little flower, who died quite young but has been sainted, and she had this sort of encounter with, she became a saint, if we can use those terms. She became a saint very young precisely by being weak, and she would talk about I just need to be weak and then God can't ignore me. So there's this really kind of interesting idea here, and I think Jeremiah's touching on this. When I'm needing mercy, then I'm going to attract the attention of God because he's the all-merciful one, the one whose mercies never cease, the faithful one, the unchanging one, the one of full of loving kindness. And when I am in need, I am being recommended by my circumstances to God in a way that I could not recommend myself by being good, by being righteous. So my need, my weakness, my inability becomes the very thing that introduces me to God and that recommends me to God. It's a little bit like, if I understand it correctly, a mother with her baby. Now, dads can sometimes tune out babies. Mothers cannot. The baby needs me. Wah, right? The baby cries, bang, I'm going to do it. I'm going to, whatever. Now, you don't always give them what they want, but you always respond because they're great need, right? I mean, that's part of it. You call it love, but really, in part, you're responding to their utter helplessness. Now, I know you're going to think this is weird, but that's the way I feel about our cat. I cannot ignore my cat when he goes, you know, meow. I'm like, oh, what's the cat need? Because that sound is going to drive me nuts. So my wife and I have this dialogue, right? She's like, why is the cat out in the rain? He wanted to go out. He's a cat, Oz. You can say no to the cat. I'm like, no, I cannot say no to the cat. The cat wants to go out. He's a big boy, you know. Anyhow. But that's a little bit what Jeremiah is saying here. My own need gives me hope. I can wait. Why? Because God is a merciful God. The steadfast love of the Lord never ceases. His mercies never come to an end. They are new every morning. Great is your faithfulness, O Lord. That's, I think, a pretty interesting thing to contemplate, that idea. Now, of course, for Jeremiah, these aren't immediate fixes. Waiting and hope are two different, Hebrew words that are translated either hope or wait, depending on the translator's choices and the context. And so hope and wait aren't, it's not like I wait because I have hope, it's either or. All of this is this attitude of expectant looking to God and choices to act in a way that lines up with our claim to wait upon the Lord. And so what does waiting look like? Well, one of the things that Jeremiah tells us, it means being silent and sitting. Now, most of us don't wait that way. I don't know if you remember life before cell phones, but here's some of the things that happened occasionally in life before cell phones. Somebody says, let's meet at Tim Hortons at 4. And I'm like, gotcha. And so the next day or whenever it was, I go to Tim Hortons at 4 and I'm sitting there and it's 4, it's 4:10, it's 4:15. I'm like, was I at the right Tim Hortons? Did he say 4? And I'm running through all the possible scenarios about, did I get it wrong? And I'm like, I need to go to the Tim Hortons over there because I bet you he meant, you know, remember those days? I couldn't just text him and say, where the heck are you, right? And so if I don't know how to wait, and I'm not doing a good job of waiting right now, what I'm doing is trying to solve it. I'm trying to fix it, right? I'm not waiting. I'm planning how I'm going to fix this situation, figure it out. And I finally get up and leave and go to the other Tim Hortons just as they're pulling in, right? You know, or whatever. You've been there. I know. I know you. I know that happened. Life before cell phones. What a delight. Anyhow, that's not waiting. That's not what Jeremiah says. Be quiet. Be silent. Now, probably, I like to think that this is a call to silent prayer, contemplative prayer, and that might be part of it, but probably Jeremiah is saying, and don't whine while you're doing it. Don't complain. Don't be, you know, all meh, 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 meh. If you're going to wait, keep it zipped, because that's the true waiting. The true waiting heart is the one who's at rest. Not because God has fixed it. So we look at this story, and Jairus, like the disciples say, oh, come on, Jesus, you're in a crowd, everyone's jostling you, and you're going to ask who touched you. But Jairus standing there, I mean, can you imagine him be like, what? Gee, come on. You're really going to stop and like search the crowd and see who touched you? What's wrong with you, Jesus? My daughter's dying. And in fact, that's what happens. And the people come and they say, your daughter's dead. Why bother the teacher anymore? One commentary suggests that the reason Jairus is there himself instead of someone else is that people were like, don't go to that wacko Jesus. Don't get him involved. And as soon as it's like, as soon as they have a reason to pull Jairus back out, they're like, come on. All hope is lost. Your daughter's dead. And Jesus overhearing, in fact, the Greek can be translated ignoring. I don't know how the same word can mean overhear or ignore, but it could mean, I guess, overhear, but dismiss. Jesus, and I like that idea, Jesus ignoring what they said, says to Jairus, don't be afraid, only believe. So this is a waiting, and now Jairus has to, like, is he going to vent? Is he going to go, what's wrong with you, Jesus? Why were you dragging your feet? Like, is he going to listen? Is he just going to wait at rest? Can he ignore not just the report, your daughter's dead, but the mourners and the laughing and mockery, the mocking that comes when Jesus says, she's not dead, she's just asleep. And part of waiting is learning what to ignore, to shut out those voices. There's lots of voices that tell us it's ridiculous, it's hopeless, it's impossible. But faith or hope, a true confidence in God says, yeah, I know, but I'll still wait. I'll still wait. So the benefit of these disappointing circumstances in our life, when they become severe, maybe we can learn to come earlier before we are absolutely at wit's end, before we absolutely have no other recourse. But that's probably where we begin learning this. But we take our disappointments, we take those lost causes in our life, we take ourselves if we are a lost cause, and we say, I will be glad in this because Jesus specializes in lost causes. Because when I am needy, then God must respond because He is a God of mercy. Whatever else is going on in my life, I know that this cannot be the case, that the mercies of God have dried up, that God has ceased to be merciful. Whatever else is going on in my life, I know that God is a merciful God. So as Jeremiah says later, put your mouth in the dust. Who knows? Perhaps there is hope. And that's this kind of insane, and it is insane at some level, posture and position we take when we say yes to the mercy of God in light of our context, in light of all the voices that would tell us that this is impossible. You remember Job and the counsel his wife gave him, why are you such a stubborn old fool? Curse God and die. And that's what despair counsels us as we come to the end of our own abilities, as we come to the threat of those lost causes in our own lives. Just give up. Just drop it. Just, why bother the teacher any longer? But Scripture invites us to remember this. Jesus specializes in lost causes. And I'm really glad about that. I'm really glad about that. Amen.